This session is Add Justice to Your Shopping Cart. And I'm Peter Thompson, and this is Ricky Thompson. And we've been doing these sessions together on ending hunger. And we just want to emphasize again before we start that what our sessions are not on hunger. They're on ending hunger because we want a positive approach. We want to end hunger. We want to take action toward alleviating the problem of people not having enough food, people dying from starvation or diseases caused by a body weakened from malnutrition. And so it's a very hopeful, positive approach. We want to say that every time because the word, like Ricky said a couple nights ago, ending doesn't go with hunger in most people's minds. So that's why we want to look at these issues and go through them. And just as a background, what our message is that hunger exists, it doesn't need to, and you and I are the key to ending it. Through participation, through action, whatever is comfortable for each person. Whether it's prayer, or whether it's fasting, or whether it's selling all your goods and moving to the third world and working for a private volunteer organization, or whether it's volunteering at your soup kitchens, or whatever it is. And so we want to really empower everyone here to educate themselves and then take action based on that education. And you, when we get into these sessions, there's so much participation and there's so many issues that everyone knows about. And today, it's going to be no exception. A lot of times we don't have time to get back to, well, what can I do about it? So we brought this up, and this is a chart from the Franciscans, and they have really outlined all sorts of things that you can do. And so if you want to take a little time and look it over, in these four areas, knowledge, to educate yourself, and that's what this meeting is really all about, in terms of your lifestyle, changes you can make or things you can look at doing, in terms of your church as a group, and then in terms of political action. And you can do one or any of them. Some people are political, some people aren't political. It doesn't matter. Your action needs to be something that fits yourself, your personality, your lifestyle. And then here are increasing levels, I would say, of commitment. There's a nice place to start for everyone right here as a first step. It would be comfortable for everyone at Holden. And some people, you know, may want to be down here in terms of their lifestyle or in terms of political action. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I end up representing a lot of people who are doing this right down here. You know, they're getting arrested for civil disobedience for various reasons, a real extreme. But not everyone needs to do that to be able to be participating at some level where you're comfortable and where you're really making a difference.
Do you know where one could write to get a copy of that?
We just asked Bob Baker, who's in charge of the Resource Center. We liberated this from the Resource Center, and he's checking for us right now. He's not sure himself where. So we'll try.
We want one, and we will go home. So if you leave us your name and address, we'll just order a few, and we could send you one because this is a real wonderful chart. We've never seen it before, and that's another thing. Our sessions don't tape very easily because we really look to you to teach us as much as we're teaching, and so I don't think the tapes come out very good, but we really want a lot of participation, and that always happens. So if you just get these three things, hunger exists, a billion people go to bed hungry every day, 20% of the population, it doesn't need to, we produce plenty of food to feed everyone. And you and I are the key to ending it. The missing ingredient is committed action by individuals and groups of individuals working for the solutions. There are many, many, many solutions and many organizations, but that's the missing ingredient. So we hope to empower you to feel that you can make a difference. And so before we get into the particular topic, where we left off yesterday, we're really having some strong debates about the Green Revolution, about fertilizers and about pesticides and all sorts of those things. And I thought, you know, those debates sometimes tend to put people on different sides of questions and who's right and who's wrong. And really, nobody's right and wrong here. we all want the same thing. We'd all like to alleviate injustice and poverty and hunger. And so just to make that message real clear and that we're all heading the same direction, I just want to start with a 4-minute little video, which is a slideshow, and it's John Denver, and he's singing the song, I Want to Live. And it shows people, a lot of the things we're talking about here are third world issues, developing issues. It shows the people that we're talking about. And it shows them in their life, and it shows them all struggling and working for justice and for survival for themselves. And so I'd like to just start with this 4 minutes, and then we'll get to add justice to your shopping cart.
I want to be.
title of our session today is Add Justice to Your Shopping Cart. And a lot of the things I'm going to say comes from this little book. You'd be amazed how much they packed into this little, I don't know, $1.50 book that's at the bookstore. And I really recommend it if you're interested in these issues. Another couple books that are in the bookstore, also just excellent, go right to the point, books about hunger, things to do in your church. As we walk through a grocery store, traveling just a few feet up and down the supermarket aisles, we're really connecting with people all around the world. And this is a fairly recent phenomenon. Years ago, that wasn't really true of eating habits, what we ate. We tended to eat foods that were available, both seasonally and geographically. We ate a lot less variety of food because we ate what was close by. The food was much less abundant. And I think very important, we ate food that was not as convenient. I think in all of our lives today, a big priority for us is convenience. And I think if you don't take anything else away from this session, and this is something I guess I'm lecturing myself as well as anybody else, to take away with you questioning convenience. What's the importance of convenience in our lives? Getting to Holden is inconvenient. I think that's part of the beauty of it. Living in Minneapolis is inconvenient in the winter. That's what part of what makes it a wonderful city to be in. It's an inconvenient place. Having kids is inconvenient. And I think a lot of our foods, I don't think I have to go into detail, have to do with convenience, all the fast foods. And when we stop to think about what convenience means for people in third world countries, for the people who are actually growing the food, making the food for us, what's the price of our convenience? It's a lot quicker to throw hamburger in the microwave at 5 to 6 than it is to put on a pot of beans at 7 in the morning and watch them all day. It's a lot more convenient. But maybe we all say we're too busy. Maybe we have to question our busyness. Maybe there's other priorities that we should think about, and maybe slowing down enough so that these things aren't inconvenient. So that's just something to kind of think about as we talk this morning. And when we ask, what can we do about our food system, we'll go back to that availability. If we're eating strawberries in December, there's something funny going on. Maybe we should just say, no, I'm not going to eat strawberries in December. I don't need those. I can eat what's in season. I can try to eat what's grown locally. For every dollar we spend in the United States on growing food, for every $2 we spend growing food in the United States, we spend $1 shipping it somewhere. We spend $500 million a year on fuel shipping food. That's just within the United States. So that gives you some idea. I think we're both participants in this food system, and we're both victims of it. I think you probably have all read stuff about how grocery stores kind of deceive us and trip us up. One experience I had was they rearranged our grocery store last year for our convenience, for our pleasure. And in fact, what they did was, the grocery store used to be like this. You go up and down the aisle and there's well, what they do is they put an extra aisle in here so that you couldn't just smoothly go back and forth. And it's statistically shown that the amount of food that you buy relates to the distance you travel in the grocery store. So a grocery store purposely makes you go through complicated mazes so you buy more. So those are all things you know how they put the junk food and the more expensive stuff at eye level and the all those things. And if you don't, it'll tell you right in here. when you're in the fruit and vegetable section, a new fact for me was that 65% of the fruits and vegetables grown in Latin America are dumped or fed to animals because they don't meet our beauty standards for what's a pretty apple or what's a pretty peach or whatever. Another big issue is, or one that people are focusing on right now, are bananas, and Peter's going to talk a lot more about the story of bananas in a little while. A lot of times you think that, you know, there's prime banana land, these trees just kind of naturally grew there, and so of course people should harvest them. It's not true. Bananas are not naturally grown all over the places where they are now. They started planting them in 1830s because they knew it was going to be profitable. Often people are, you know, pushed off the land, given very minimal money for their land, and then paid even lower wages to work on the land of the big corporations. When people try to protest, in 1974, there was the Union of Banana Producing Countries had a banana war. They wanted to have a higher export tax so that more of the money would stay in their country. They wanted 50 cents per box increase on export tax, and the big corporations, Del Monte, Dole, Chiquita, fought back by simply letting the bananas rot on the dock. So, you know, these are some of the things. Someone asked yesterday if this exporting at least creates jobs, what would happen if they left. Often there's much more mechanization with the big corporations, with the big landowners, so that in fact there's less jobs available. And the number of laborers needed for 1 acre of bananas today is just 1/4 of what it was 40 years ago. Also, I'm just going to read this little section. In one case, United Brands violated an agreement with the Costa Rican government to use a certain percentage of its land to grow bananas through the year 2000 because they found that they could make more money making palm oil in Africa. So they pulled out long before their agreement and left a lot of displaced workers who responded with peaceful occupation of company lands. But their protests met with little success. How many of you were familiar with Campbell's Labels for Education? Or maybe, you know, participated in that. How many of you are familiar with the boycott that was against Campbell's? Okay. The Labels for Education was you collected labels for your school and you could buy athletic equipment. So Campbell's was seen as a, you know, really wonderful, benevolent company helping our children have a better education. And in fact, and that's true, they were doing that. There was also a strike going on, which has now been settled, because there were poor wages, exploitation of the workers, poor working conditions. That part of Campbell's was a part that most of us probably did not hear about. How many of you are familiar with the Nestle boycott? Maybe I want to explain for those who don't know what the Nestle boycott was.
I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would anybody like to explain what the Nestle boycott was?
Isn't that the infant formula?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to explain it? Yeah.
Well, if I remember correctly, Nestle was promoting the use of infant formula in third world countries at the cost of breastfeeding, and then the people couldn't afford enough of the formula to have a nutritious meal for their child, so it was overwatered.
Right.
They would use more water than the formula called for. So it resulted in malnutrition.
We also use dirty water.
Yeah. And no way of sanitizing with it.
And they subsidize the doctors to get them to give the formula starter packets to the women.
Mm-hmm. There was little education. They didn't really know what to do with the formula, I don't think.
Yeah, nurses and nurses uniform selling them who weren't nurses. People in nurses uniforms.
So was they could be like Americans and, you know, use formula and be cool.
And there's tremendous advertising. We were in Sri Lanka a couple months ago, and even though the boycott was successful, and Nestle's isn't shipping our infant formula down there anymore, there's still tremendous advertising for coconut milk. And you can't walk down a street in Sri Lanka without, you know, tripping over real coconuts. But the message is that, you know, you're not a good mom unless you're giving your children powdered Nestle's coconut milk, you know. But when you're wondering about, you know, spending your dollar, that's a real good example where people said, no, I'm not going to buy Nestle's, and the consumer were successful. Okay, I'd like to talk about, there's a lot more stuff in here. I think I'll just talk a little bit about whether there's a connection between justice and nutrition. We've always been taught to shop for economy and nutrition. And what this little book is requesting of us is that we shop for justice as well. And I would like to say that I think that the more justly we shop, the more nutritiously we will shop, and the more economically we will shop. That those things are all tied together. And then also the question arises, does what I eat affect anybody else? Does it matter if I eat Twinkies and Wonder Bread and steak every night for dinner? And I would say, yeah, it does matter. And we'll talk about that some more, but I would like to say too, we all eat junk food, I think. Not everybody, but a lot of us do. Our eating habits are not always consistent with our beliefs. And I think we should always strive for greater consistency, but to not let our inconsistencies paralyze us. I did a workshop one morning, and a man was very interested. He said, but I drink 7 Diet Cokes a day. How can I help to end world hunger? But we all struggle with that. You know, we drink coffee. We drink Coke, some of us. But that doesn't have to paralyze us. I don't think we have time to sit in our guilt and not do anything. It's fine to feel guilty, but don't stop there.
I haven't seen anyone who drinks coffee up in Holden.
That's right.
There's no coffee.
They did explain last week where the coffee is purchased and how they chose to place it. I can't explain it, but you ought to ask them.
There's a great example. Like, there's a community that the Shrams run now in Minneapolis called St. Martin's Table, and what they serve is Nicaraguan coffee. And so they're trying to support people there in their economic struggles consistent with drinking some coffee. So just because it's an export crop doesn't mean it's, you know, inherently bad. There are ways to be intentional and to be conscious about all your choices, even if some of them are inconsistent.
When we're asking about, you know, does what I eat, you know, affect others, I think just in terms of, we can think about the packaging that goes into food, you know, the plastic, tin foil, things that are not biodegradable. Those things affect us all. The preservatives, the chemicals. And I'm just going to ask Peter, he doesn't eat beef, pork, or lamb. He doesn't eat red meat. And there's... Why is that? What does that have to do with all this stuff?
Just a little, we have handouts from time to time, and we've only got like 10 copies because we lugged them out here from Minneapolis, but maybe you could share and just pass out a couple here. This is, I think, a real good explanatory page. It has several points on it, and it has to do with the food chain, and I know people here are generally very conscious. When we had this week, I don't know if you were all here, but we had spaghetti one night and we had a whole wheat pasta. Was anyone here when we had that? Is there, does anyone see a connection between whether you use white pasta or whole wheat pasta, for instance, in the whole food chain idea and the preservation of resources? Anyone here feel that connection or think about it?
Well, I think white pasta is more, well, nutritionally, all of the vitamins and stuff are taken out, and when you use the whole grain, you're utilizing the resources better, I think. I don't know if that explains.
Exactly, yeah. And there has to be more processing, so more expense, so you end up having to spend more for the white. And I think traditionally, you know, when our parents were growing up and when we were growing up, if you could have white bread and white pasta and things like that, it was thought to be somewhat of a luxury because it was finer and it looked prettier and things like that. Where really, it's a little self-defeating, both in terms of nutrition and in terms of expense. So the whole food chain idea here, there's a couple of great little examples. The first one, you can see that if someone has a quarter acre of land and farms for a year, the grain they get off that land would feed someone if they had a meat diet for 19 days, they had a grain diet for 217 days, a huge difference, and if they had a soybean diet, it'd feed them for more than a year on a quarter acre. And so the use of the world's resources in terms of that has an effect very dramatically. The reasons I have chosen to eat as I do is, number one, I'm a pacifist and I don't like the idea of killing the animals, although I do eat some chicken, so you know there's inconsistencies certainly in what I'm doing. Secondly, nutritionally, I think as I eat higher on the food chain, the beef for instance, I'm making the grain less available for others, and also nutritionally, I think we have so much here. There's so much, we have too much. And by eating too much, I think we lose consciousness of that others don't have as much. And for instance, with beef, when we have the tremendous amount of meat diets that we have here, it really contributes to the cholesterol problem. The boys that were being killed in Vietnam, they were doing autopsies on them, and they're, you know, 18-year-old boys, they were, you know, full of cholesterol already. You know, I mean, think
of... a meat diet, how much meat is in that diet every day, three times a week? I'm just wondering, on this 18-day meat as opposed to the 217 days for grain, do you know?
That's a good question. I would guess, you'd have to ask Food First exactly what they define it as, but I would guess it's, you know, the standard diet in the U.S., which, you know, once you give up meat, you realize how pervasive it is, because when you go to a restaurant, I mean, a lot of times, unless it's kind of an alternatives restaurant, you can barely avoid it. I mean, even if you get a salad, it's got bacon bits on it. And if you get a bowl of soup, it's got little chunks of ham in it. And so it really, you know, forces you to be conscious every day. And then it shows down here also, this makes a good food chain where they have the three animals here. As you grow lower on the food chain, how you're using less and less, you know, it takes 21 pounds of grain to get a pound of beef, where it only takes 8.2 for a pound of pork and 5.5 for a pound of poultry. And that's the descending food chain again. And the last point on this chart, which is a real good one, is how different countries use their grain. Here in the United States, where we have a real emphasis on meat eating, you can see how much of the grains go to feed the animals, which is a real inefficient use of that grain in terms of the protein that we could be getting out of it if we used it for something else. France has a little more shift, but still very heavily weighted on the meat, and China, with 1 billion people and needing to make much better use of their resources, has just the opposite kind of blend. And of course, if they tried to do it like we did, they wouldn't have enough. They'd all be starving. Well, deer would go a lot lower on the chain here than beef because, you know, we're not actually, they steal a lot of grain from the fields, but they're in the woods browsing a lot too, so you don't have that problem. It is much leaner.
As far as the balance of nature, you know, we got in a, I teach and we got in a real interesting discussion on something. I don't enjoy hunting and I, you know, I have a hard time with it, but I know a lot of kids there, they go out hunting and they get time off school to go hunt. But we talked a lot about the balance of nature there too, you know, and allotting. That's why they allot so many deer tags and so many elk tags a year, because it keeps that balance. You know, and I'm not sure what would happen if you removed that poll. You know, all those people who are making all those controls on the balance of nature, if that would affect or not. But, you know, that's kind of how we talked about it. It's just, you know, it helps keep that balance and control, I guess.
I think there's some inconsistencies, too. Your comment about poultry, sheep, and cows, and pounds of grain per cow, pounds of grain per sheep, and chicken, and so forth. Because we're farmers, we raise sheep and cattle, and speak of in Oregon, for example, in New Zealand, countries that raise sheep and cattle. If you take that 90% of the weight gain on a sheep is put out in the hillside pastures that wouldn't grow anything but marginal grasslands. In other words, the amount of feed used per pound, yes, is only for finishing animals, but that's only, you know, maybe 5 or 10% of the weight gain on that animal. Whereas you take a chicken, and your preference to chicken, it's a totally grain-fed animal, and starts. So I think there's some real inconsistencies here in some of these facts about pounds of grain that can be misleading. In fact, sheep may be at least pounds of grain per pound of meat if any particular slaughtered animal.
Good point.
My husband's always raised his own beef. So that, I mean, just enough so that we have a steer on hand all the time. And we've been eating it regularly for, he's 76 and I'm 72, and neither one of us have cholesterol. So, I mean, I think that cholesterol is a 9 times out of 10 genetic.
And there's many other factors involved. There's many factors involved.
Yeah, it's not just the, it's not sure. Just the beef.
Yep. I think maybe as far as how what we eat affects others, we're losing the subject a little bit. Your beef that's imported from Central America is my problem. Okay. Much more so than that which is grown here. I don't like the idea that what is feeding me is starving somebody else.
And we'll get to that in just a second. And I don't think we would ever say that, you know, eating beef is wrong or anything like that. I think it's just something we need to, you know, to think about in our lifestyles, you know, but yeah, it's not.
Well, it is for some people. I mean, they tell you now that you're not supposed to have beef for cancer, that they've had all kinds of stuff. But I know people that have eaten it for years and they don't have cancer, and they don't have cholesterol or anything else. So you kind of wonder sometimes.
What about that preservative there? Yeah. Food, I think that's...
Like to use that in the bacon, don't they? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sodium nitrates.
This all brings up a good point, is that you can see that we're covering such a myriad of issues here that, I mean, the real healthy thing here is to have a debate about it so we become conscious. We don't have all the answers to all these questions, but, you know, to be conscious about these things, to study them, and then to make conscious choices in your own life. And you look what the impact is and you know, how you may be impacting by, you know, if you can eat deer, if you can eat beef, or if you're going to spend your money for pork in the store or whatever. you know, that's, we're not here to tell you what to do. We're just here to raise those issues so everyone can think about those, learn more about them. If anyone wants to take this one little issue, say meat and nutrition, and study it for a week, you'll be a long ways ahead of where Ricky and I are right now, because, you know, we don't know, we're not experts on all these different topics. So the debate and the discussion is, I think, real important.
Can you sort of give direction as to how this knowledge can help stop world hunger? I mean, knowing that maybe beef is an efficient conversion of grain and protein, by not eating beef, does that mean there's more grain? We'll have bigger surpluses to feed people who don't have it? Is that the kind of implication here?
There's not always a direct, you know, it's like our parents saying, you know, clear your food, the kids in China are starving. We can't always say, if I don't eat this hamburger, somebody else is going to have grain. I think sometimes those connections are real explicit. But sometimes we have to do it just for our own conscience, for our own, you know, consistency in what we believe about the environment and the use of the environment.
So if enough people do it, I mean, if we think of kind of a super intelligent fashion where I want to behave the way I would want the majority to behave, if that would happen, I mean, then does the ball start rolling to solve something?
Sure.
You do make a difference through your individual action. I mean, you make a difference, and you can't really say how everyone else should do it. For instance, I couldn't shoot a deer. I'm not saying shooting a deer is wrong, but I couldn't shoot a deer myself. But that makes a difference. And just like when he shoots a deer and eats it, but is doing it in a conscious fashion because there are plenty of deer, and maybe then won't be buying something else, you know, he can be making a difference too. So we all do. It can be very frustrating and lonely if you think that by taking one particular action, you're going to convince everyone else to do something. And I think it gets back to faith, you know, you have to look at these things, decide what is just, and act in accordance.
And leave the rest, you know, I know one thing that was off. I learned from being here at Hold and other times is that the rest is up to God, that it's not in our hands to decide what's going to make history happen. That's, you know, we do what we think Christ might have done, and then we let God take care of the rest.
In response to what he said, and to follow up on something you said earlier that bothered me, to do what is comfortable for us. If we were comfortable, to be comfortable is to do nothing. And I don't think God ever called us to be comfortable. He calls us to do a great deal more than we would like to do.
That word stuck in my throat as it was coming out. It was the wrong word to use. What I was meaning, and I'm glad you mentioned that, what I was meaning, I think we should always stretch ourselves, but sometimes if people think, well, in order to be consistent, I've got to be on level 4 on everything, they say, it doesn't work, I'm giving up, I'm not doing anything. So I think they should stretch, but I think they should do something that doesn't defeat them. In other words, you know, they should do what's right for them in terms of their own conscience and belief, and rather than comfort. Comfort is totally the wrong word. Thanks for pointing that out.
Maybe not even that.
What would be a good word for expressing that? We'll get that by the end.
Challenging.
You know, we have a lot. This really, really probably gets us right to some of these things. We have three readers here. We've got three little vignettes that's going to start putting this thing together, I think, for us. The eating and the justice and the how what we do impact others. And each of the three, would you pass out and also read? We have little scenes from some different countries here. One on bananas. One is on cows for fast food, and one is the day in the life of a blueberry picker. And there's again just about 10 copies, so maybe you could share them, and we've got three different readers who will be passing them out.
Yeah.
You could just listen to
it. This is the human cost of bananas. Anselmo Paga is a 67-year-old Filipino farmer. He lives with his wife and five children, all but one of whom work on the banana plantation. Here he tells what happened to him and his family when the banana plantations were started by Dole, Delmonte and Dole. After the war, we became tenants of Beldua, a local landowner. Our crops were corn and fiber. I was tilling a 3-acre plot, but not in this area. It was somewhere near the present banana packing plant. When the company started here, we did not know what to do. We were living on that land that is now full of bananas. We were just told to leave. 3 weeks later, they bulldozed our crops and the posts of our houses. So what could we do? They paid us only a few hundred pesos. For my 3 acres of crops, they gave me 300 pesos, about $20. Others got even less. Some did not get anything. Most of the landowners, like Beldua and Umagog, became banana growers. But the land is not really theirs anymore because they have so much debt to the company. Nowadays, you can barely count on your fingers those who remained farmers. Everybody seems to be working for the company. So if I can help it, I will never work for the company. So I grow a little bit of corn on the land. Life is really hard today, even for the workers. Even on Sundays, people are working. They have to earn. Our life was better before. Today, all the workers have their masters. They cannot stop their work to rest, even for a moment, because if they do, they will be kicked out.
Any responses to that concerning this whole thing? Justice and...
Where was that again?
That was Philippines. There's another banana story I want to give you. This is just by way of example in Honduras. And this gets into some of the economies that we're talking about. If there's real economies, if there's not. An organic banana costs about 79 cents a pound, if you can find it. Chiquita banana costs you about 39 cents a pound, and it looks a lot prettier. Now, which is more economical to buy? One of the things you have to keep in mind are some of the human costs that you've just heard.
What do you mean by an organic banana? What is that? What do you mean?
That's grown not on the big plantations, okay. Not with the pesticides. They're grown, many of them here in this country. They're grown in other countries and shipped here that are just grown, like we can get them in our co-op. Do you know where those come from?
I don't. They're okay. Not gassed like the other ones. They make them pretty and yellow.
They aren't spray, and they look grungy, you know.
Okay.
They're kind of dark and this and that. And it was a real interesting thing. Would you tell them about what they said about Michael when he was born and organic bananas? For a diet? Do you remember?
Just not to feed him too much, not to feed him well.
Our baby wasn't very healthy when he was born, and one of the things that was recommended that be fed to him was organic bananas. And it was organic instead of the regular bananas, because the regular bananas, you know, have traces of like DDT in it and things like that. So it was recommended to us that we get organic bananas. And that's the first time we really started doing it, because we couldn't get them at our local store. Now down in Honduras, I just want to go through quickly, just keep in mind some of those economies. I mean, when you go and you think about 79 cents versus 39 cents, it's real easy what's more economical. In Honduras, United Brands and Standard Brands, because of favoritism from the government, own the only railroad line in Honduras. So they're able to ship them much more economically, to the disadvantage of the small growers, of course. Secondly, the U.S. government has regulations on what is an economical unit of shipping. And their regulation makes a single freight car no longer economical as opposed to a 100-car unit train. And so those regulations specifically support the large grower. The pesticide use, which has been referred to, most bananas which come from the large plantations are sprayed up to 6 times with pesticides. And that gets us back into the cycle of poison that somebody mentioned yesterday about, we don't allow DDT to be used in this country anymore, so the people that manufacture it ship it to the third world countries where they don't have regulations against it. It gets used extensively. It's getting used on the land that the plantation owners own, like in the Philippines here, that used to be owned by the peasants who were displaced from the land. Now many of the peasants live on the edge of the plantations. They're also sprayed. It causes them serious health problems. So you have to take that into account on the cost of the particular banana. I mean, what's that worth? What's that worth to us? I've mentioned this a couple times, but in Central America, the mother's milk in many of the areas is 42 to 45 times higher in DDT levels, the breast milk, than is recommended by the World Health Organization. One whole group of male workers, because of a particular banned pesticide that was being used in Honduras, became sterile. So how do you add those in to the 39-cent banana that looks so much nicer? The average banana field worker in Honduras earns about $1 a day. It used to be his land and he had that to use for his whole family. How do you figure that in terms of wages? That's about $400 a year. Most of those people live in dilapidated housing, no running water, improper sanitation, and they're actually, a lot of them are illegal squatters because the company now owns all that land. Another thing that is happening down there, and we'll get that in the next thing we read, is that many of the rainforests are being destroyed in order to provide more land for both grazing cows and for bananas down there. And sometimes what they're doing is, even when the banana plantations, they have enough bananas, they are taking paraquat, which is a very potent pesticide, and getting rid of all the bananas by using this pesticide and then turning it into pasture land. And the cows then will graze on the pasture land for a few years, and then because the land wasn't originally meant for that use, it was originally meant for a rainforest, the land is really rendered useless. I have an incredible picture up here of this land that used to be rainforest. Only half of the rainforest that we had on the planet is left now, and the land is actually turned into a desert after the cows graze on it for about 3 years, and there is no more grass that comes back, which has tremendous impact in terms of, you know, ozone layer and oxygen production and endangered species in the rainforest and all that sort of stuff. This comes in to the factors of whether or not the 39 cents is economical. The whole land control issue, which we alluded to, 3% of the population owns 80% of the land down in the third world countries. Strikes usually aren't allowed. There were some strikes, and there are strikes from time to time. Ricky told you about the banana war in 1974, which was lost. There was also a strike and an uprising in 1954, and there was actually a lot of workers who were killed. And there is no right to strike down there for them to improve their working conditions. Jack and Sarah were down in Honduras in 1983 with a friend of ours, Terry Gibbs, and they were out with some priests and nuns at an organizational meeting of workers to try and look at how they could improve some of their conditions and wages. As soon as they got done with the meeting, the military was there, boarded their bus, came on with guns, and confiscated all the notes and took the names of all the people that were there. So in terms of the oppression that is going on, you know, that is a factor which really should be taken into account in the economics of purchase. Finally, one factor that came up last night is that, you know, in Minnesota there's been much to do in the last year about the fact our National Guard is going down and working on the roads in Honduras every year. They're making a great big roads, and they're, you know, going down with bulldozers, and there's been some protests about it by the people from Witness for Peace because of possible preparation for war. But really, those roads down there, they're not used at all by the people. The people don't, you know, the poor people don't have cars. The executives of the large companies and the landowners have cars, and the military have vehicles. And another important use beyond whether there's going to be military engagement down there is quelling any of these disturbances or organizations or collectives in trying to unionize or have their rights. So, I mean, our taxpaying dollars are going to build roads down in Honduras. And that doesn't come out. What that comes out is a lower price for Chiquita, and you know, so that's another way that the price gets down to 39 cents a pound. So one thing I've decided, and I don't think anyone else needs to decide this, but in terms of a choice, that I don't want to have any more Chiquita bananas coming home from Lund's, our supermarket. So those are a lot of the factors and that go into the banana story. Any responses about those sort of things?
Has there been any attempts to organize a boycott of Chiquita because of this? I mean, Nestle's boycott was successful.
I don't know.
I think if there's enough indignation about that, it will happen.
Does anybody else know?
Yeah, there's a boycott in Switzerland that is organized against Chiquita.
There are a lot of boycotts I've heard of in Europe on a lot of different products that I never heard of in the United States. I think we're much slower to challenge the PR in our country for a lot of the big, I mean, Chiquita and Campbell's and those people have a wonderful image in my mind. It's a lot to overcome to really say you're going to take a stand against them.
It just seems to me that you know, if the government, our government, allows our corporations to operate in this fashion, allows these products to enter our country, if our companies, in fact, are controlled by people who want to have that sort of thing continue to go on in society, whether or not I buy their product is going to be almost an endless process of trying to change them. Because if they don't grow bananas, they'll grow something else. And I guess I appreciate your concern there, but it just seems to me that unless we can somehow persuade our government and large corporations to want to be more in tune with justice, that it'll be this grabbing quicksilver where they, if they get out of bananas, they'll go into something else. You know, I mean, people who want to spray poor people, I mean, that's not buying the product to me is a very mild response.
Are there some responses to that?
Well, I think the political problem is the problem in those countries too, not just in the United States. The political problem is the problem, and it's always going to be a problem as long as you have human beings running.
Who owns Chiquita Bananas? Do you know?
United Brands and Standard Brands.
Are they owned 100% or is it partly owned by Honduras interests?
Well, I don't know. I think it was American Fruit. You know, there are a lot of stories about these sort of things with American Fruit down there, and then they have become United Brands and Standard Brands, and I think they maybe have some Honduran subsidiaries and things like that.
This is interesting to me because we're living in Japan now and they're so strict on imports and things, but one thing I noticed is they have Chiquita bananas. Mm-hmm. So.
If American corporations had never gone to South America and corporations from other countries had not done the same thing, would there be no hunger in South America now? And if those corporations were to leave now and the land redistributed, would hunger cease in South America?
I don't know if we can answer, you know, I don't know if we would know that.
I think a good parallel is down in Trinidad, what's happened in Trinidad. It's not, maybe not Central America, but they have a lot of roots to Central America. And I've done a lot of work in Trinidad, building a plant in Trinidad. And
I followed their evolution from their days when they were released from Great Britain. And as a matter of fact, by the major multinational corporations pulling out and the country being turned over to basically removing that influence, actually the food production in the country went down dramatically to a point that they totally depended on import food. And they're just finally starting to recognize that problem today and starting to reverse that. But when your large multinational corporations actually pulled out of that country, they reverted. Basically, their interests were mainly centered on improving their lot in life and totally distracted from the discipline of maintaining their own agroeconomy.
Yeah, I think that would be a pretty normal, I would think, reaction. That you'd just kind of be in a state of trauma, not knowing what to.
Yeah.
It would take a while to, you know.
That was an orderly transition. Mm-hmm. It wasn't one where they were just kicked out. They were systematically bought out.
Sure, but I still think it would be
education and some time spent preparing these people for that.
Well, I guess my question, though, coming from that, is I'm confused by what you're saying. I think I hear you saying is that, well, we boycott Chiquita and we make the peasants go back to a small acre, get back to profit to small farm interests and try to develop that resource as opposed to some outside influence developing a organized agro system, be it bananas, coffee, or whatever. Is that what I hear? Is that correct?
She's been waiting a long time, and I would like to respond to that.
I just had a response to you, and then also to you up there. What I understood is what we originally started with is before the multinational corporations came in the first place, people in all these third world countries, maybe not all, but most, survived for centuries and centuries the way they were doing just fine, providing food individually for their families on their small plots of land, mostly growing things enough for their own families. And then the corporations came in, and since then there's been, I don't know how many generations of people living under the corporations, and then as a corporation draws out, these people, the problem isn't that they don't know, the problem is partially education, that they don't know how their whole economy has been based on something for a long time, and then to entirely reverse your economy, it would be like changing the United States economy from a war economy to a peace economy, or the whole economy would collapse because we're used to subsisting a certain way.
So
I think that re-education and it's such a tremendous problem, but redistribution of the land somehow. But once you change an economy so drastically, it's difficult to regain the simplicity of the survival that was taking place in the country previously. But we can't forget that these people, we must give them credit in that, yes, their system worked before our country came and changed it.
Love to talk to you, I guess. It's time for lunch.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.